This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Tax shelters of the rich and famous. A new investigation explains how the wealthy, from presidents to celebrities, hide their assets to avoid the tax man.
It's like an elaborate kind of party cake with multiple tiers.
We speak with two journalists about their slices of that cake. Also today, London police offer safety tips in the wake of a murder committed by one of their own.
It would be laughable if it wasn't so tragic.
And a volcano on Spain's Canary Islands is still erupting. Banana farmers there are worried their crop is in danger. And looking for a new career? What about getting a master's in the Beatles?
There are people who are born in the 21st century who are hardcore Beatles fans. And we're looking at how and why this one particular group has such impact.
Cuckoo, ka-choo, 101, and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us this Monday. Another bombshell revelation about how the rich and powerful stash their cash to avoid paying taxes. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists detailed who's doing it, where and how it's done, and the impacts on the rest of us. The new investigation is called the Pandora Papers. Reporter Luke Harding with The Guardian was one of the reporters who worked on this. Before we dive into what you did specifically, Luke, what is the big takeaway here? What's the headline and what have we learned?
Well, Marco, I mean, I think the big takeaway is that across the globe, including in the US, including in my town in London, there is a two-tier system where the ordinary guy, ordinary citizens, ordinary voters, dutifully pay their taxes, while a small, exclusive group of rich people, sometimes politicians, sometimes billionaires, sometimes heads of state, you know, those guys not so much.
So you, Luke, and several hundred journalists around the globe have been poring over the data and documents. What do these documents actually look like? What are they?
Well, it's just, I mean, what the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists put together is really just a vast searchable database.
I mean, one thing that is pretty extraordinary is that 600 journalists were able to keep this all secret until yesterday. How much did you know or understand about how big the whole project was? Did each of you only see the piece that you were working on?
You know, at a time when most newspapers are broke, what's interesting is this kind of collaborative model. And we have a sort of philosophy of radical or extreme sharing. We share everything. We know everything. Within this kind of closed group of journalists, there were kind of groups, almost like Facebook groups. We were literally sharing every lead. It's a bit like sort of panning for gold, because you can spend quite a long time, many hours, looking at this stuff. And then suddenly you get a nugget.
Well, nuggets have emerged in the past 24 hours, pretty tantalizing ones, and more will be coming. Your story yesterday in The Guardian, Luke, is about Vladimir Putin's inner circle and how they hid their wealth. Your story leads with a pretty juicy finding about Putin's alleged former lover. What did you find?
A rather intriguing young woman whom I found in the data called Svetlana Krivonogic, whose story is like something out of a fairy tale. She was basically working as a cleaner in a store, and suddenly she acquires this mysterious benefactor who's a upwardly mobile politician in the city called Vladimir Putin. And in very quick order, she acquires a huge number of assets. As part of her kind of shadow portfolio, there was also a rather glorious $5 million condominium in Monaco, overlooking the Mediterranean with a view of gigantic super yachts cruising to and fro. And this had been acquired in 2003, just a few months after she gave birth to a baby daughter called Luisa, who, it's been alleged in Russia, is actually also the daughter of Vladimir Putin.
So getting back to the revelations, Luke, you mentioned earlier the accountants, and maybe the most important player in this whole story is a sort of mundanely named law firm called Moores Rowland in Monaco. Who are they and how did they facilitate the stashing of wealth in Monaco and around the globe?
What we discovered is this firm, as you say, Moores Rowland in Monaco, run by a British guy called Eamon McGregor, son of a British bobby, British police constable from the city of Liverpool, where the Beatles grew up, had been quietly managing the fortunes, the billions of Vladimir Putin's sort of closest friends, like his alleged lover, like his best friend, like the butcher he grew up with, and so on.
So, Luke, can you give us one example of like one of these corporate structures that's used to hide these millions?
It's like an elaborate kind of party cake with multiple tiers. For example, the Monaco apartment of Vladimir Putin's alleged lover was bought via an offshore company called Brockville. But Brockville was in turn owned by another offshore company called Sefton or Sefton Securities. And the woman, Svetlana, she had what's called a bare trust agreement, a kind of a sort of legal deal with Sefton Securities. And the point about this kind of convoluted sort of structure is that her name vanishes from the records.
So the most jaded listener right now, Luke, could say, well, no surprise, rich people get away with things. What is the takeaway for you from this whole story? Why does this matter?
It's really a sort of wake-up call for voters to actually try and get their politicians to do something about this.
Well, as you said earlier, if it were not for the leak, you'd have never known. A lot of citizens around the globe today will be incensed by this news. How much of what is being revealed, though, is actually criminal?
That's a good question. I mean, there's nothing inherently illegal about setting up offshore structures. And, you know, people do sometimes have genuine reasons for doing so. But it's all about secrecy. I mean, you have an offshore company registered in someone else's name, which owns another offshore company. I mean, it's like a kind of Russian doll. You know, it's very, very hard to find out who is the ultimate owner. And it might be a legitimate rich person, or it might actually be a super crook.
Luke Harding is a reporter for The Guardian newspaper who, along with hundreds of other journalists, has been working on the Pandora Papers for months, his story about secret wealth transfers among Vladimir Putin's inner circle, published on Sunday. Luke, thank you very much for being with us to discuss this.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Lebanon is one of the nearly 100 countries caught up in the Pandora Papers expose. The trove of documents pinpoints the hidden offshore tax havens of some of Lebanon's most powerful figures. That includes the new billionaire prime minister and the governor of its central bank. These revelations are not going over well in Lebanon, to put it mildly. Alia Ibrahim is the founder of Daraj Media, an independent Lebanese digital media group. It's one of the many local partners of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that brought the Pandora Papers to light. Alia, you're in Beirut right now. Most Lebanese knew their leaders were not squeaky clean. We now see that of all the countries in the world, Lebanon tops the list with the number of offshore companies. What are some of the other big revelations from the Pandora Papers?
We're looking, for example, at the head of the central bank, who since the 90s have been taking his own money outside while telling the Lebanese depositors and Arab depositors and others that the currency here is very safe and that they can keep their money inside the banks. His own money is well kept in safe havens, in real estate, etc., etc., while the money of depositors and the average citizen is locked in the bank and they can have no access to it whatsoever.
So can you give us a few examples, Alia, of the kinds of investments and tax shelters that, say, the governor of the Central Bank of Lebanon, what has he established for himself offshore?
We've been investigating the central bank governor for over a year. And the reason we did that was because he has been at the helm of the central bank for 30 years. What Pandora gave us is two very specific companies. One of them is actually headed by him as a director, which is a violation of the credit and money law in Lebanon. This by itself should be enough to isolate him and to investigate with him. Another company that is owned by his son, it was relative to a huge real estate development project that was taking place in Lebanon. Yes, it's true that not every offshore company is illegal. And yes, it's true that it's not necessarily hiding a criminal act. But when we do such investigative work and it gives us access to information that is otherwise not available, and it could shed the light on the behavior of people who are in high political positions that can have an impact on the daily life of every single citizen in this country, this is really very empowering from a journalistic point of view.
We've been seeing since the Panama Papers, since Paradise Papers, and now with Pandora, unless there is strict diligence when it comes to politically exposed people, when it comes to people in the closed circle of politicians and of power, the abuse of offshore companies is going to go on.
So a few years ago, if we look at the context here, Lebanon's currency collapsed, unable to pay its debts, and that is currently the status quo. Average Lebanese can't even draw their own savings out of their bank accounts. What are Lebanese citizens saying about the details in the leaked documents?
It's another unbelievable chapter of a very, very boring soap opera that has been going on over and over. In this crisis, over $6 billion have been taken out of the country, mostly belonging to politicians and their business affiliates. If you drive around Beirut right now, it's really, really heartbreaking. There's no electricity, there's no gas. It's a country that has so much potential that has completely been ripped off by its political class. And now we're learning that this political class has managed to take its own personal wealth outside of the country. I mean, if this is not really infuriating, then I don't know what would be.
So, Aliyah, activists in Lebanon are calling for action and accountability. Real accountability, though, would demand an independent judiciary to hold the powerful to account. What would it take for that to happen?
This is a very good question because, you know, activism has happened. The Lebanese have taken the streets by millions, and then people could not do it anymore because they really have to go back to work. In a country, I forgot to mention, the August 4 explosion, which literally destroyed almost half of our capital. Till now, neither in the explosion nor in the collapse, not one person have been held accountable. Without accountability, we're not going anywhere. The Lebanese judiciary is full of excellent judges. It just happens that those who are in power and the key positions are not the most decent ones.
Aliyah Ibrahim in Beirut is the founder of Daraj Media, an independent Lebanese digital media group, one of many local partners of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that brought the Pandora Papers to light. Aliyah, thank you for your time and for your reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, dear. Thanks.
An update now to this story we've been following, that volcanic eruption on Spain's Canary Islands, which began 2 weeks ago. Hundreds of buildings have been damaged and thousands of people have been evacuated, but residents are not totally in the clear. Last Friday, new lava flows were detected emerging from a third vent. As the world's Lucia Benavides reports, one group of people is especially on edge.
10 days after the Cumbre Vieja volcano began erupting on the island of La Palma, the slow-moving lava reached the Atlantic Ocean.
Lo estamos viendo en directo. Está cayendo al mar. Está cayendo. La lava ha llegado al mar.
Local news channels reported live as lava fell from a rocky precipice into the seawater last Tuesday, creating a white cloud that could potentially carry toxic gases. Hundreds of residents have been ordered indoors as the chemical reaction can irritate eyes, skin, and respiratory systems. The expanding lava is also adding to the island's surface area. More than 40 acres of new landmass has been created by lava swallowing up beaches and flowing into the ocean.
El volcán va a cambiar. Va a cambiar la topografía de La Palma.
Geologist José Mangas from the University of Las Palmas in Gran Canaria spoke on television last week saying that the island's topography will undoubtedly change to the point where maps will need to be updated. He said volcanic eruptions like this one tend to last weeks or months, and it's still unclear what routes the new lava rivers will take. The damage done to Las Palmas' infrastructure is estimated to be at more than $20 million, and that number's likely to rise. Businesses, restaurants, stores rely on tourism that may be affected by the destroyed beaches. Agricultural workers have not been able to pick up their harvest for 2 weeks.
Por esas mismas evacuaciones a tiempo, no ha habido desastres humanos, pero acá.
One banana farmer told local news that while timely evacuation saved human lives, it's been a catastrophe for many workers. La Palma is one of the largest banana producers in Spain, exporting 140,000 tons a year and creating 15,000 jobs. It's the island's driving economic sector. Millions of bananas are being lost as farms are destroyed or farmers are unable to water their plantations because of broken pipes, resulting in an estimated loss of $32 million.
Ahora sí. Dale.
Videos uploaded to Twitter show workers cutting stalks of bananas as ash rains all around them. They then hurry to blow the ash off the bananas before it works its way in and ruins the fruit. But as the volcano continues to erupt, solidarity grows. Hashtags have appeared on social media to encourage Spanish residents to buy more bananas from La Palma and help the local sector.
El martes que viene traemos plátanos de Canarias.
School children in various Spanish regions will even start bringing bananas as their morning snack. For the world, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Coming up on the show, North Korea has been flexing its muscle with missile tests recently, but it's also sending signals that it might be ready to make nice with South Korea. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. North Korea's government has just reopened its emergency hotline with South Korea, a bit of good news from the peninsula. The hotline serves as a direct connection between Kim Jong-un and South Korea's president, Moon Jae-in. That's not the only friendly gesture coming out of North Korea. Pyongyang is also dangling the possibility of formally ending the Korean War between the two countries. Technically, it's been a live conflict since the 1950s. So what is up with the sudden warmth from Kim Jong-un, and what does this mean for the U.S.? The World's Patrick Nguyen is on the line. Why the change in tone from North Korea, Patrick, towards its neighbor in the South?
Yeah, well, short answer, Marco. North Korea is trying to butter up South Korea in the hopes that South Korea will pressure America to pull back North Korean sanctions, if you can follow that. It really is a big change in tone, though. North Korea used to talk about turning South Korea into a sea of fire, and more recently they said the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, is like a dreamy-eyed little boy. And they call him dreamy-eyed because he really, truly has been trying to establish peace between North Korea, the U.S., and South Korea, which would be a truly amazing feat. Less than 2 weeks ago, President Moon came to the U.N. General Assembly and said, "I want to end the Korean War on my watch." So Moon is basically saying ending the war would lead to a new era of peace on the Korean Peninsula and ultimately lead to North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons. But we have to look at the timing here. President Moon only has 6 months left to make his dream come true because when his term is up, he can't run for re-election. South Korea is going to the polls in March. So he might be getting desperate. That's what North Korea is thinking. He might be getting desperate to go down in history as the great peacemaker. And so North Korea is saying to him, the clock is ticking. If you want us to end the war, we'll play nice, we'll play along, if that will motivate you to go out and get us what we really want.
So butter up South Korea, get the U.S. to understand that North Korea can compromise, and then ease up on sanctions on North Korea. Is that the only end game here, Patrick?
Well, I think the ultimate end game for North Korea, they want some things that South Korea alone cannot give them. Kim Jong-un has been pretty explicit about this. For all we say about the mysterious North Korea, he's pretty explicit in saying he wants America to drop its hostile policy, meaning these extreme sanctions that basically shut off North Korea from the global economy. So President Moon's usefulness to North Korea is perhaps he can go to America and convince them to roll back sanctions. As for how well he would be received by the Biden administration says, "We're down to meet North Korea at any time, any place to talk." And Biden's team has even complained that North Korea won't pick up the phone. Kim Jong-un, while he's buttering up South Korea, will also say he's not falling for any more, quote, petty tricks from America, in which he shows up to a summit and walks away with nothing, as he did several times, as you know, with President Trump, former President Trump. So basically, North Korea is saying to Biden and Moon, "You'll get your peace talks when you get real about sanctions." So they're stuck in a rut, the U.S. and North Korea is. And it now seems like North Korea is pumping up Moon Jae-in, South Korea's president, to pull off something big. America and South Korea are major allies. President Moon should have the power to get Biden's attention, though, of course, we know the White House is always distracted by many other crises.
So while all that's going on, Patrick, North Korea has been testing new missiles lately. How are we supposed to understand this friendlier demeanor from the North while they're building up an arsenal of long-range missiles?
Yeah, North Korea has been testing more missiles, most notably a brand new hypersonic missile, which is very hard to intercept, some cruise missiles as well. But if you really look closely, Marco, what they're not doing is testing any of the long, long-range missiles that tend to cause a lot of problems. The long, long-range missiles that could potentially hit California or even New York. And that is noteworthy. President Moon himself has said that is noteworthy. He said, look, it looks like Kim Jong-un is only raising tensions so far because he wants to keep the door open for talks. If you fire a long-range missile that could potentially hit the U.S., the door slams shut. You know, you're moving towards a crisis. People in South Korea and even Japan are starting to hunker down. So if you think about it from North Korea's perspective, it's under severe sanctions from the U.S. at a time when it's faced a pretty severe hunger crisis, and the U.S. just keeps these sanctions on autopilot, cruising along while it deals with Afghanistan and China and its own domestic issues. So the missile tests are Kim Jong-un's way of saying, wake up. And if he can get Moon fired up to go to Biden and push him to roll back sanctions, now would be the time to do it before President Moon has to leave office.
The World's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen. Thanks very much for this update, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
When Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed entered office 5 years ago, his arrival was met with a lot of optimism. There was hope that he would move Ethiopia beyond its troubled past. Today, Abiy begins his second term, and 5 years on, the mood is very different, darkened by the year-long conflict in Ethiopia's northern region, Tigray. Here's the World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi.
Today in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, Abiy Ahmed was sworn in for a second five-year term as prime minister. The ceremony took place at the Parliament Building, and Supreme Court Chief Justice Mieza Ashafani was presiding.
Abiy Ahmed Ali.
Abiy raised his right hand to solemnly accept his position as head of state once again. But for many in Ethiopia and outside the country, this moment is dampened by the ongoing conflict in the Tigray region. The violence there has cast a shadow on Abiy and his administration. Letitia Bader is the Horn of Africa director at Human Rights Watch. During a recent news conference, she laid out some of the human rights violations that Abiy's forces and their allies have been accused of.
Massacres, sexual violence, forced displacement, but also deliberate attacks on civilian objects and civilian infrastructure.
Tigrayan forces have also been accused of human rights violations as the conflict has expanded to other parts of the country in recent months. Efforts to provide humanitarian access to millions of people affected has been a struggle from the beginning. The United Nations says vital fuel and medical supplies are being prevented from entering into Tigray. Here's Bader again with Human Rights Watch.
The government has continued to say that it is facilitating access, but the humanitarian community has repeatedly said that the trickle which has been allowed in is not sufficient to deal with the massive needs.
Relations between Ethiopia and much of the international community soured even more last week after Ethiopia declared seven UN officials as persona non grata. They were told to leave the country within 72 hours. Prime Minister Abiy's government accused those officials of meddling in Ethiopia's internal affairs by diverting humanitarian assistance to Tigrayan rebels. The UN Secretary General expressed his shock in a statement read out by spokesman Rial LeBlanc.
He said, I have full confidence in the UN staff who are in Ethiopia doing this work. The UN is committed to helping Ethiopian people who rely on humanitarian assistance.
Another UN spokesperson told me that those United Nations staff members have since been moved out of Ethiopia for their own safety. One of them is part of a joint human rights investigation into the conflict in Tigray. That final report is expected to be released next month. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
The situation in Tigray has sounded alarms around the globe. Find more of our coverage on what's going on in northern Ethiopia at theworld.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. One bright spot to come out of the pandemic, huge new medical advances in vaccine technology. And the progress doesn't stop with COVID.
It could completely change the way vaccines are made.
India is one of the countries leading global development for the next generation of vaccines. And we speak with the first woman victor of France's cycling race from hell. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Britain, public confidence in the police is badly shaken right now. A London police officer was sentenced last week to life in prison for the brutal murder earlier this year of a young woman, Sarah Everard. Today, in a separate incident, another London police officer was charged with rape. Women's rights groups say the response by the force looking into the attacks has been tone deaf. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, reports.
Thousands of people gathered at a vigil in Clapham Common last spring, near to the road in South London, where 33-year-old Sarah Everard was last seen. They wanted to express their sadness and outrage at Everard's killing by a serving London police officer. But as the day went on, things turned ugly. Police moved in to break up the vigil, saying it broke COVID rules, and they arrested several women. Last week, some of those women were outside the Old Bailey in London. That's the courthouse where police officer Wayne Cousins faced sentencing for Everard's murder. In a rare ruling, Cousins got life in prison with no option for parole. The head of the Metropolitan Police was at the courthouse too.
There are no words that can fully express the fury and overwhelming sadness that we all feel about what happened to Sarah. I am so sorry.
Cressida Dick said that Sarah Everard's death raised important questions for London Police.
I absolutely know that there are those who feel their trust in us is shaken. As Commissioner, I will do everything in my power to ensure we learn any lessons.
Later that day, the same police force published a list of suggestions on its website, telling women what they should do if they suspect a police officer is not who they say they are. Officer Cousins had detained Everard after falsely accusing her of breaking COVID rules. Call the police on 999, the statement advised, or shout out to a passerby, or wave a bus down and ask the driver for help. Women's rights groups were appalled at the advice. Erin Mansell is a spokeswoman with Solace Women's Aid, a domestic abuse charity in London.
Some of the implications of those recommendations imply that had Sarah Everard taken a different action, she might have been safe. And the idea that you could have asked this man who is intent on brutal attack and murder, if you had asked him why he was alone or asked to use his police operating radio to contact the operator, that that would have stopped him, I think is, you know, it would be laughable if it wasn't so tragic.
The Met Police is also now looking into a WhatsApp group that Cousins was part of, where he's alleged to have shared offensive material with fellow police officers. Dr. Zubeda Haque is a former deputy director with the Runnymede Trust, a think tank focusing on racial equality. She says the police are acting like the Wayne Cousins case is an isolated one.
The reality is, it's not just a bad apple here. You know, we have wider systemic failings with violence against girls and women in this country. We know that. Even within the police force, we know that in the last 5 years, there's been over 800 allegations against police officers or police staff, and only 43 have resulted in a conviction, only 5%.
In the last few days, former female police officers have spoken out about a culture of misogyny in British policing. Parm Sandhu served with the Met Police for 30 years. She told the BBC that female officers are afraid to call out their male colleagues for inappropriate behaviour.
On one occasion, I did report it, and then I was vilified. Because what happens is that male police officers will then close ranks. And the fear that most women police officers have got is that when you're calling for help, you've pressed that emergency button on your radio, they're not going to turn up and you're going to get kicked in the street.
The British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has promised to spend an extra $34 million on making streets safer for women. But Erin Mansell, with Solace Women's Aid, says that's only part of the problem. She says the Wayne Cousins case is a reminder of how reports of sexual violence are not taken seriously by the police. Two previous allegations of inappropriate sexual behaviour against Cousins were never followed up. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Sunday that the system needs to change.
We will stop at nothing to make sure that we get more rapists behind bars and that we have more successful prosecutions for rape and for sexual violence.
But some will find Johnson's promises hard to believe. The Prime Minister has refused to hold an independent public inquiry into the police handling of Everard's case, saying he's waiting to hear the results of a police inquiry first Dr. Zubaydah Haq says this isn't good enough.
It's an astonishing thing to say when the entire sum of the problem is lack of trust with the police force. And, you know, this isn't the first time that we've had this issue. We know that there are huge issues of lack of trust between black communities and the police force in this country.
Now there are calls for the head of the Met Police to resign. Many women's rights campaigners say, despite the outcry over Sarah Everard's death, the Prime Minister's response and that of the London Police Chief show that little is likely to change. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The pandemic has sadly disrupted our normal lives in many respects. There have been silver linings. One good example, the pandemic has ushered in a new era for science. We're now on the cusp of yet another generation of vaccines, ones that use DNA, with India leading the way. As the world's Ilana Gordon reports, this new class of vaccines could also help fight diseases beyond COVID.
Traditionally, vaccines send the actual virus, or parts of it, into your cells. It's inactivated, it's no longer infectious, but it trains your immune system to recognize and respond to it. A DNA approach sends in the code or recipe for part of that virus that then instructs your cells how to create that part.
It just has that little blueprint of the virus, that little sequence, so that it tells your body, make an immune response against this so that it can protect you.
Amit Patel is a scientist at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia and a lab that's been pioneering the DNA approach for years for diseases like Ebola and cancers. She says DNA is similar to these new mRNA vaccines for COVID-19, like those from Pfizer and Moderna, but there's a difference.
So mRNA, it gets sent to the cells and then it starts translating right away. What happens when you give DNA is that it needs to make mRNA first in the cells. And so you just have an extra step in the recipe that your cells take care of.
There's advantages and disadvantages to each kind. Scientists here are among about 24 groups around the world that are developing DNA-based vaccines for COVID-19.
I mean, I always spent a lot of time in the lab, and when COVID happened, it definitely increased how much time I spent here.
She leads me around a bright open space area. It has lots of counters, biohazard containers, and pipettes. At the end of a counter is a small machine that has a glass case and a mechanical lever.
So this is called a plate washer.
The lever moves plates. They look more like large video game cartridges. And they have about 100 little dips in them that hold samples of blood serum. The lever moves that plate behind that glass case, where a vacuum and washer performs chemical tests on those samples.
To understand whether or not we have immune responses against our DNA vaccine and see whether or not there's antibodies or not.
The COVID-19 vaccine developed here is in the final clinical stages. It's being tested around the world. But in India, a DNA vaccine was recently authorized. It's the first in the world and a point of national pride. Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasted about it during his speech at President Biden's vaccine summit at the UN last month.
Two indigenously developed vaccines have received emergency use authorization in India, including the world's first DNA-based vaccine.
The vaccine is called ZyCoV-D. It's three doses, and the country is expected to roll it out any day now once they finish negotiating prices. Scientists at the company Zydus Cadila in Western India developed it and put it through a trial involving nearly 30,000 people. They reported an efficacy of 67%. Here's Sharvil Patel, Zydus's managing director on CNBC International.
We believe this platform will allow early adoption to any new strains or variants that get created. And the platform is extremely safe, which will aid in terms of the vaccination.
Independent scientists like Dr. Shahid Jamil are really excited. Jamil is a virologist at Ashoka University, north of New Delhi, and at Oxford University in the UK.
It could completely change the way vaccines are made, manufactured.
Jamil says DNA is a much more stable molecule compared to mRNA. It's easy to make and store. It doesn't need super cold freezers.
Look at the possibilities of vaccinating people in parts of the world where you cannot maintain a cold chain.
But this kind of vaccine isn't perfect. For decades, scientists have had a super hard time generating a strong immune response in people using DNA approaches.
Muscle cells don't capture DNA very well. And whatever little they capture, they don't really process it very well.
One workaround now is that instead of a muscle jab, they're figuring out different ways to deposit it under the skin. This is where Jamil says the right kinds of immune cells are able to capture the DNA.
So that seems to have worked quite well.
The Zydus vaccine uses a special fluid jet that penetrates the skin. There's no needle. But Jamil says what really excites him is that DNA vaccines are easy to modify, and the technology has the potential to be really accessible.
In future, you can even think of having little DNA-making machines in doctors' offices where you can churn out vaccines if this technology takes up.
Kind of like a vaccine printer, where the code could be sent through the internet from, say, Mumbai to Nairobi. Jamil says we're not there yet. In many ways, scientists are at the beginning. After decades of research and trials, COVID-19 has finally pushed forward DNA's proof of concept. The true test now is starting in India to see how well DNA vaccines actually work in the real world. For the World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte announced this weekend that he is retiring from politics when his term ends next year and not running for vice president as he had planned. This week, across the Philippines, candidates are filing to run for president, including Duterte's daughter, a boxer-turned-senator, and the current mayor of the capital city, Manila. Whoever wins will follow on the heels of an administration that has been tumultuous and sometimes downright shocking. Reporter Ashley Westerman takes a look at the legacy of President Duterte, a bombastic, crass populist, through three specific promises he's made to the Filipino people.
First, let's take a look at Rodrigo Duterte's signature promise.
I propose to get rid of the drugs within 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, get rid of the country's huge drug problem in 3 to 6 months.
One could argue that he made good on that promise.
That's Ross Dugade, a human rights attorney based in Manila. She says this promise played particularly well with middle-class voters who are credited with helping elect Duterte.
Because it was such a visceral topic. A lot of people feel so unsafe in the streets of Manila. And it's been very frustrating living in the Philippines, knowing that a lot of violent crime has been happening.
Right after inauguration in 2016, Duterte immediately launched his now infamous war on drugs, which has drawn the ire of human rights defenders and even an investigation by the International Criminal Court. In the last 5 years, more than 6,000 Filipinos have been killed in drug-related operations, and that number is according to police. Human rights activists estimate the number of these extrajudicial killings is actually 3 or 4 times higher. Still, Dugade says it hasn't gotten to the root of the problem.
It targeted your street peddlers. It targeted even people who are innocent, who are just suspected of dealing with illegal drugs on the streets. And the big drug lords haven't been brought to justice.
The drug war remains popular with Duterte's supporters, she says, so the issue is likely to be huge in next year's election. Another promise Duterte made during his campaign was to, quote, end the insurgencies afflicting the country. The Philippines deals with a widespread communist insurgency, as well as a secessionist rebellion in Mindanao, the country's Muslim south. The Philippines is overwhelmingly Catholic. Muslims only make up about 5% of the population. Here Duterte is in February of 2016, advocating for a more federalist solution for dealing with the secessionists, who are sometimes quite violent in their tactics.
Hindi pwede magsama yung dalawa. Kaya federal, bigyan mo sila, bigyan mo.
You can't force them to merge, he says. Instead, let them have their autonomy. And that's what he did, by partnering with secessionist groups to establish the Bangsamoro Organic Law. The landmark 2018 agreement is essentially designed to give Muslims in the region more autonomy. The peace deal is unlike anything his predecessors were ever able to achieve, says military historian Jose Antonio Custodio.
That was a promise of the peace that did push through. Okay, so in a way, one could say that at least with the secessionist, he was a bit more successful than with the CPP-NPA.
That's the armed wing of the Communist Party of the Philippines. Custodio says that when Duterte first took office, he ordered talks with them, but they never really got off the ground.
There were still operations going on and ambushes going on, and eventually it led to a deterioration of relations between both sides.
Custodio says Duterte is leaving office amid outright hostility with the communist rebels, an issue that will fall to the next administration. The final promise we're going to look at has to do with infrastructure, an issue that has long dogged the Philippines, an archipelago nation of more than 7,000 islands with multiple metropolitan hubs known for horrendous traffic. In 2017, Duterte promised,
"We will make a few years the golden age of infrastructure in the Philippines to enhance our mobility and connectivity and thereby spur development, growth, on equitable in the country. In other words, we are going to build.
His administration said it would increase government spending on infrastructure and has been eyeing some 100 projects, including a bridge system to connect the three main parts of the country. But as Duterte's time in office comes to a close, political analyst Richard Haydarian says it's been a mixed bag. While the big-ticket projects haven't really pushed ahead,
what I understand is that they're the non-big-ticket infrastructure projects, more medium and small-scale projects that have been actually kicking in, especially in the more peripheral regions, including Mindanao.
Haydarian notes that while Duterte never really had a cohesive vision for his infrastructure plan, the president's over-reliance on China may have also hurt him.
I think in many ways, perhaps he was taken for a ride. I think the Chinese promised him a lot. There was a lot of pledges, up to $24 billion in investments.
But to date, most of the Chinese-funded projects have yet to break ground. Haydarian predicts that because Duterte didn't do so well building, that may end up hurting his allies in the next election. But perhaps luckily for those filing for their candidacy this week, experts predict the pandemic and reopening the Philippine economy will likely be the dominant issues in 2022. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
Let me take you down, because I'm going to Liverpool. British students looking for a new and different line of academic rigor can now pursue a master's degree at the University of Liverpool in John Paul George and Ringo Studies. And I'm not talking about merely diving into the Fab Four's music and taking a comp lit approach to the lyrics. Holly Tesler is leading the new program and joins us from Liverpool. So, Holly, what exactly are these master's candidates going to be learning about the Beatles?
So we're really taking a cultural and industrial approach to understanding the question of how and why are the Beatles still so popular in the 21st century, some 50 years after they broke up. So it's something that's substantial, particularly within the heritage, culture, leisure industries.
So what prompted this idea in the first place?
Because I had done my PhD on the Beatles in Liverpool, lots of people were getting in touch, very interested to study the Beatles. And at the same time, the university was looking to expand its postgraduate, what we Americans would call master's study. So the opportunity came up. I proposed the idea for a Beatles MA, and happily, it went through.
So in your course, you use terms like intermediality and narrative theory to describe the Beatles as a cultural brand. Can you explain those terms?
What we're looking at is this idea of how the stories of the Beatles circulate. So transmediality then is the idea that we hear stories from lots of different areas. So we'll see a TV show, we'll read a newspaper article, we'll read a book, we'll watch a video, and all of those different media tell stories in a particular way.
What's been the reaction to studying the Beatles at the master's level? Are people excited about it, or have you heard some dismissive attitudes?
The students themselves are really eager. They're a great bunch of students, very dedicated, very enthusiastic. We've had a lot of energy in the room. It's been brilliant from that regard. In terms of the reception more broadly, overwhelmingly, it's been positive. There are, of course, people who say, oh, what are you doing a degree in the Beatles for? But those are the same people who have issues with studying music or art or culture in general.
So as a Beatles fan, personally, I love this idea. But do you think it's going to be easy to carry on for a long time in a sustainable way?
One of the things we're looking at is the reasons how and why the Beatles still connect with people. So what we're looking at is how people still connect, interact with them, how their stories intersect with contemporary culture. So I do think we'll have lots to talk about for years to come.
How do you expect your students to take what they learn in this line of study and apply it beyond campus? In other words, when they go to their parents and tell them about their studies, what answer will they give them when they're asked, how are you going to make a living knowing about the Beatles?
We wanted to ensure that there is an employability element to it. So we've intentionally targeted the degree to people who are looking to work in the tourism heritage leisure sector. So even if they don't work in Liverpool or in Britain, what they can do is study how the Beatles work as an industry here and can apply it to their own places and areas of the world.
Have you heard from Paul or Ringo about how they feel about becoming subjects of advanced academic study?
Not yet. They haven't called me yet. I live in hope.
So finally, Holly, you're from Philadelphia. What started your own interest in the Beatles to such a degree that you're now running this program at the University of Liverpool?
I came to the UK to do my master's degree in 2001, just before George Harrison, unfortunately, had died. There was so much media attention and people from all over the world descending on the city and just the outpouring of grief. It really sparked an interest in me in thinking about how and why the Beatles are still so influential. And I'm still here 20 years later. Teaching the Beatles, I may.
Holly Tesler is a professor at the University of Liverpool, where she's teaching a new master's program on the Beatles. She joined us from Liverpool. Thank you very much, Holly. Great to meet you.
Thanks very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
This weekend, I could not take my eyes off a bicycle race in France, the famous one that runs from Paris to Roubaix in the north, one of the oldest cycling races in the world. History was made on Saturday when British cyclist Lizzie Deignan rolled across the finish line at the Roubaix Cyclodrome. Deignan won Paris-Roubaix, considered one of the hardest bike races in the world. It is nicknamed the Hell of the North. 70 miles to take riders across uneven cobblestones, made even more treacherous when it rains, and it rained. Also this year, for the first time, women cyclists had their go at the course, which makes Lizzie Deignan the first queen of the cobbles. Lizzie joins me now, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So I've seen videos of you skidding on your bike through the mud in this race. Paris-Roubaix doesn't have the elevation of the Tour de France, but it's got different challenges. What are they? What did you experience?
Yeah, I mean, Paris-Roubaix is just iconic because of those cobblestones, wet, slippery cobbles, and the vibration that comes off the cobbles when you're traveling at those speeds. It's pretty tough to handle, and it has this famous following because of the uniqueness of the race over the cobbles, really.
And even the trophy for the winner has a cobblestone on it, right?
Yeah, a very heavy cobblestone, I found out.
So take us to that moment when you crossed the finish line at the cyclodrome in Roubaix on Saturday. What did that feel like?
It felt completely surreal. I mean, as a cycling fan for years before I was racing, we would spend a Sunday afternoon watching the men's Paris-Roubaix, and I never dreamt that I would be able to be part of history, I suppose. I definitely felt kind of the weight of history on my shoulders. And rather than it be a burden, it did feel like it kind of gave me wings. I felt incredibly proud of not just myself when I crossed the line, but of all the women who have kind of fought for that moment.
We got the news recently that next summer, 2022, will be the return of the women's edition of the Tour de France. Are you going to do that?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, it's all about team selection, but yeah, that would definitely be a dream. It's huge for women's cycling that we have the biggest stage in cycling. You know, that platform of the Tour de France is huge, and I'm really grateful that we're making that step.
Is something shifting in the world of cycling that seems to be opening up these opportunities for women cyclists?
Yeah, I think so in society in general. I think there is less and less room for inequalities, and people are talking about inequality when it happens. That's kind of reflecting in sport as well now.
Mm. At the same time, I see that your winning purse as a woman in Paris-Roubaix is a 20th of what the men's victor got. So what more needs to change?
Yeah, that was disappointing, obviously. But I'm riding for Trek Segafredo, and actually they have been for the full season matching the men's prize purse for our women's team. And what it takes is companies like that standing up for what's right.
Well, you paused one day having won Paris-Roubaix, and then I gather you raced again today in the first stage of the women's tour in Britain. You don't take a break, do you?
No, cycling is a pretty relentless sport. Yeah, I mean, it's an endurance sport, so we're used to racing lots. At this point in the season, I'm happier to be racing than training, to be honest.
Lizzie Deignan, the first winner of the Paris-Roubaix Femme for women, the famously hellish bike race held every year in northern France. Lizzie, congratulations again. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.